Pseudopod, episode 162, October 2nd, 2009. This week's story, Suicide Note, written by an alien mind, by Ferret Steinmetz. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from Ferret Steinmetz. Ferret has been published in Asimov's Bards and Sages and Edges of Propinquity, and he is a 2008 graduate of Clarion. He also has a story, Camera Obscured, in this month's issue of Asimov's, and can be found online, when he's not playing Rock Band, at the splendidly named Watchtower of Destruction blog. Your narrator this week is Phil Rossi, author of The Excellent Crescent Station, which is available now from Amazon. Phil's current podcast novel, Harvey, is also well worth your time, and for anyone experiencing True Blood withdrawal in particular, a visit to Harvey should sort you right out. So stand to, because I have a story for you. And I promise you, it's true.
Suicide Notes, written by an alien mind, by Ferret Steinmetz. He had been trained, as all of us had, to assemble his rifle by touch. But to our dismay, we discovered that Private Sperling could do it in near silence. He pushed the parts together with delicate care underneath the stiff, thin sheets of his bunk bed. The click of pins and bolts so muffled that none of us heard a thing in the cramped confines of our modular shelter. In our defense, we were doped up on lithium. But even if we hadn't caught the faint scratching of the cleaning brush, plunging in and out of the bore like an obscene masturbation, we should have heard him crying. Afterward, Sperling's bed was a smear of stains, grease on the sheets, tears on his pillow, blood on just about everything else. We didn't know that the Decorai had made contact with him. Sperling's first bullet shattered Tommy Battenfield's skull, leaving his body twitching on the cot. The noise yanked me out of a jittery sleep, startling me into tugging the trigger of my gun. But we'd learned from hard experience not to sleep with the safety off. I opened my eyes just in time to see Sperling put a bullet through the head of my bunkmate. Domingo had his pistol out and was already aiming down the barrel, but Sperling's second shot put his brains through the mixer. I threw my covers aside and leapt out of bed as Sperling blasted Joseph Holcomer, whose feet were halfway to the floor when Sperling caught him through his left eye, slopping a nice, fan-shaped pattern against the wall. I was still fumbling for the safety as Sperling turned the rifle in my direction. He sobbed tears of relief, muttering my name as he leveled the barrel at my heart. I went numb with fury. I'd survived 3 meat grinder battles against the goddamn Decorai and their servants, and here I was, about to be shot by a thrall in my own bed. I'd signed up to kill the fucking globs and keep our homesteaders safe, and now I was going to die without ever having seen one. There would be no revenge. Sperling's eyes held no malice, just a sweaty, glazed happiness. But that was scant consolation as my friend Sperling pulled the trigger. My loyal, steader buddy, Roland, tackled Sperling shoulder first, sending the shot down into the thick rubber floor. I could have kissed him. Sperling fell to the barracks floor, already swinging his rifle around to fire at Roland, but I stomped on the stock with a steader howl and kicked it away. Sperling scrambled across the floor, but it was too late. Every grunt in the dorm swarmed on him. We yanked him to his feet, 3 men clamping to each arm as Sperling thrashed and wailed. "They're beautiful," he screamed. "See the ugliness in your eyes? Split it open. We can't be separated. They won't gift us with death. That's my job." We carried him towards the door, yelling for a doctor, shouting that Sperling had gone native and needed a dose of Liprazam, stat. And suddenly, he surged in our arms, diving head first towards one of the prefabricated metal beds. He snapped his head down to smash his windpipe on the sharp end of the die-cut strips that held the bunks together. Sperling choked to death, his last words meaningless, spit-filled rattlings as 3 sets of brains cooled on the walls. It had taken maybe 45 seconds. It was the third time this month. Roland and I were the only ones singing at the funeral. We didn't have any folk songs in common. His family raised Nutricorn on a hand-scrabble Kansas-class world, whereas mine plucked gene-engineered bananas on a jungle fruit plantation. But we were both from places where death was so common that the only way to see it out was with a lot of alcohol and a lot of singing. Since they wouldn't give us booze, we hollered Auld Lang Syne at the top of our lungs to see poor Sperling, Battenfeld, Holcomer, and Ganter out. Our fellow soldiers kept their distance, shifting uneasily on the benches as they watched us sway and weep by the four aluminum coffins propped at the back end of the mess hall. Their blank stares urged us to sit down, but we glared right back at them. We were Stedders. They were just soft city boys who'd volunteered for the 10 acres of land they'd get once the decorai had been cleared out. The thought made us giggle. From the way our fellow soldiers swatted sting flies in panic whenever we stepped outside our air-conditioned, stamped metal living quarters, we guessed our bunkmates didn't know soil from shit. What would they do with a farm? If our singing made them squirm, they'd probably puke when they had to help their own sister give birth. Our fathers, on the other hand, had fought their own battles a generation ago and won their own land. Roland and I stood to inherit our family farms, but we hadn't signed up to make a profit. We'd signed up because the homesteaders here needed protecting from the telepathic decorai, and because fighting was in our blood. We were good at it, too. "Come on, fellas, sing!" Roland encouraged them, waving his arms to the rhythm. Reluctantly, a few of the boys joined in glumly, turning our joyous lungbusters into dirges. I couldn't blame them. When I looked at our squadron, all I could see was the gaps left by the dead and deserted. Sperling brain-burned, Ganter shot, Hennington hung by his own rope, Ryback and Mongaham, K.I.A. Hell, the reason we were singing was because the chaplain had scampered off in the middle of the night, leaving us with no one to lead us in prayer. Next time we went on a bug hunt, Chaplain Bloke would be waiting, rifle in hand, all his thoughts of God neatly sniped away. A sergeant appeared at the edge of the mess hall, tapping his wrist impatiently. Roland and I looked at each other, surprised to find ourselves in charge. "All right, guys," I said, shrugging. "Show's over. Say your regrets fast, because we gotta clear out the room in 7 minutes to make room for the next wave of recruits." As we walked out, we could sense their relief at the silence. They didn't care much for our backwater ways. But I saw Roland quietly reach into his pocket to caress the picture he kept tucked next to his breast. And I knew I just couldn't creep out of that room. "Show him," I whispered, poking him in the ribs. He looked startled, then grinned conspiratorially. "Yeah, buddy," he whispered back, and we fist-bumped. Then he whirled on his heels to brandish the photo at them, holding it out at arm's length to give them all a good look. "The next time you feel weak," I thundered, "just remember what happened to your loved ones, and fight them! Fight for Mary Markham!" They were startled, but then heads started bobbing, and Bauman gave me a bare-toothed, snarling grin of anger. Then Whitby and Delacour raised their fists in salute, and a cheer went up. And the next thing you know, the entire room was shouting, "For Mary! For Mary! For Mary!" The stomp of their boot heels sending shudders through the thin metal walls of the mess hall. Roland's grip was unwavering as he made the men look at the photo. Me? I went to sleep every night with that photo reflected against the backs of my eyelids. 15 minutes after my father had shown me Mary Markham, I was broadcasting an application to the local recruitment center. The photo was of a small boy thrusting a pitchfork through the belly of an attractive young woman in a gingham dress. Poor, dead Mary Markham. Her eyes, already glazing over with death, were looking at her son with abject horror. But he had lost interest in his mother already, and was turning his boyish, murderous gaze toward the photographer, overjoyed at finding someone new to kill. That was what happened when the decorai touched your mind. Maybe the city pigeons had signed up out of hope for a better life, but from the reverent way that Roland held that photo, I knew that he and I were carved from the same wood. We'd signed up because anything that could make a Stetter boy kill his mama was something no sane person could allow to live. They wanted a better life. We wanted to make lives better. Sometimes Roland and I laughed about how we should have been enemies. He followed the tenets of Islam, whereas I drank the sanctified blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. He barely knew how to read, whereas my father had made me memorize Bible verses by candlelight. But though our gods had different names, Roland and I fought for the same cause, and I loved him for that. We turned to leave, but found our way blocked by a fat corporal, his pudgy face as smooth and hairless as a balloon. He cleared his throat. "If you, boys wouldn't mind, we have some news for you." He coughed. He fanned his hands weakly, and it took us a moment to realize he was trying to wave us back into the room. Roland and I exchanged wry grins, but obediently returned. Our fellow soldiers stiffened when they saw the corporal make his way to the four aluminum coffins propped at the front of the room, not acknowledging the dead men behind him. Two important notices, he said, clearing his throat. The first is that some of you boys are skipping your nightly medications. It is crucial for the war effort that you take your neurotropic supplements. Preliminary tests seem to indicate they strengthen the brain's resistance to mental domination. We understand that it's, inconvenient. He finally glanced at the coffins, and I wondered if he'd even bother to learn their names. But we're hoping to work the grogginess out soon. Roland leaned over to whisper in my ear. Now, that sounded a lot nicer than "we have no damn clue, here, have some drugs," didn't it? I chuckled, but then felt tension knot itself up in my stomach when I realized that, Christ, they really didn't know what the hell to do. Take our weapons away, and the Decker I attacked at night. Dope us up, and Sperling could shoot three of us before we shook the sleep off. Give us nothing, then the men shot themselves instead. The other thing, the corporal continued, is that we have discovered another alien base. The invasion begins in 4 hours. This we hadn't expected. The previous assaults had roused us in the night. We'd never gotten noticed before. One of the nice things about fighting a telepathic species, the corporal said, fidgeting with manicured hands, is that we can't hide our plans. They know we're coming, so there's no need to keep it a secret. By the time we figured out it was his awkward way of making a joke, it was too late to laugh. Roland caught me by the elbow as I grabbed my rifle for the big push. Here, he said, thrusting a small blue necklace into my palm. His upper lip was beaded with sweat. Take this. A ceramic eye hung from the silver chain. What's this? A Nazar, he said, dangling his own necklace between calloused fingers. It's from my mom. Wards off the evil eye. It's kept the globs out of my head for 3 missions, so I had her send me one for you. Honor and shame duked it out inside of me. My father would have whipped me for just touching the holy symbol of another religion. Roland, I said slowly, I can't wear this. Neither can I, buddy. He said jovially, clapping me on the back. Technically, wearing charms is forbidden by the prophet, but every bit helps, right? I wanted to tell him that he was full of shit, but instead I put the necklace on. It felt cheap and tawdry, and I tucked it under my shirt to hide it. But Roland tugged it back out with a grin. Has to be on top, he said, patting it affectionately. We both have families to protect. He held out his fist expectantly. I smiled and bumped it back with my knuckles, figuring that Dad would forgive me. Men did stranger things in combat. Our squadron filed out through the bio-locked barriers into the open air, feeling the fierce burn of the sunlight sizzle into the thick smears of sunscreen on our arms. Dekara's stratosphere held only a wisp of ozone, so your skin would blister up without protection. The twisted landscape was hellishly fertile. It'd be great once Stetters cleared out the low, thorny scrub brush, replacing it with gene-engineered crops designed to strangle the local flora. But in the meantime, the brush just made plenty of nesting places for stingfly hives. We'd burned out enough space to land a battalion of dropship helicopters, and we filed our way along with thousands of other sweating soldiers into their bellies. It was hot and airless in there, and we fanned ourselves with our helmets, stirring the ash on the floor of the holding bay in little swirls. The half-an-hour flight was filled with the hum of the chopper's silenced blades and the mutter of men praying, rubbing their own talisman, writing final emails home. Roland whistled. "Kill and fill, man," he muttered, staring out the window as we approached the target. "Kill and fill." Our fellow soldiers squirmed in their seats, and I shouldered my way over to get a look. There were no roads or blasting caps on this world, just wilderness left to grow as it damn well pleased for thousands of years, and it apparently had taken quite the liking to the steep mountain the Decorai called home. It was a big, craggy peak made of soft rock and sandstone, riddled with cave entrances, nearly buried under an overgrowth of century-old trees and knotted bushes. For every cave entrance we saw, there were four more that we didn't. But you could bet the Decorai and its thralls knew all the entrances and exits. There was only one Decorai in there, holed up in the heart of the mountain. But being telepathic, it was surrounded by a horde of vicious creatures who fought for it. They were native to this planet, squat, mole-like animals with domed heads like dum-dum bullets and wet glycerin eyes the size of a man's fist. We called them trolls. They seemed intelligent, but there was no way to tell, because every single one of them had their brains co-opted by the globs. All they did was let loose shrill rebel yells and try to kill us. They were unnervingly successful at it. And if they weren't deadly enough, they were helped by hundreds of human deserters who had gone native, taking our armaments with them. One of the fresh recruits snorted, his eyes going wide at the steep slopes of the mountain. "Fuck," he drawled, and placed a cigarette out between his lips. "Just nuke the place." "Great idea," I said. "We'll give you the 10 acres downwind from it." The kid shut up. Roland gave me an eager thumbs up for putting down the pigeon, but the nervousness in his eyes sent a chill through my heart. Every whirl of the chopper's blades brought us closer to the Decorai, and closer to losing our minds, literally losing them to something else. Roland fingered his Nazar, staring at the peak, and as always, I started double-thinking, checking every thought twice to see if it felt right. Was this fear really my own, or just some emotion implanted by the Decorai? How could I tell? I looked at the soldiers around me and judged the fear to be justified. Any one of them could turn on me, seized with alien thoughts, to put a bullet in my back. I wanted to kill the fucking globs just for giving me that continual terror, that lack of trust. But it didn't matter. The mountain was the current objective, and both Roland and I knew the plan long before the lieutenant commanders explained it to us. The steep slopes meant we had to throw all the bodies we had at the Decorai, swarming them from every direction like ants. If we were lucky, one of us would stumble upon a path to where the damn Decorai was, and ending the battle with a single bullet to the head. But before that happened, the mouths of the cavern entryways would run with blood like fresh wounds stabbed into the soil. "Ready, men? Go!" a lieutenant screamed as the chopper banked around to hover over a thicket, churning up dirt and old branches. Roland and I grabbed nylon and rappelled down. And my God, they had trapped everything. We scrambled up the hillside to the open mouths of cavern faces above, but the world was filled with meaty snapping noises. I saw Bauman pushing his way through a snarl of thorny bushes when he disappeared into it like it was water. I saw a flash of flailing pink hands, and then heard the broken calliope hissing sound of punctured lungs trying to scream. A helicopter full of troops veered straight down, its pilot gone kamikaze with Decorai lust, immolating the squadron underneath it as it went up in a blaze of smoke. Boulders tumbled down the slopes at the touch of hidden wires, grinding men underneath. And through it all, there was the clean snap sound of rifles firing. Brain-burned snipers, schooled and trained with all our skill, shot anything that stayed still, forcing everyone upwards into the traps. I heard a choked cry and a rush of air behind me. Roland was gone. "Roland!" I screamed, looking around, wanting to find a trace of my Stetter brother. I lurched back a few steps, searching for where he'd fallen through, but the matted thickets were too dense to see through. All I could hear was explosions and gunfire. I called out again and again. The snap of a sniper's bullet forced my legs into motion. I ran uphill, away from Roland, filled with greasy shame. Were those my thoughts? I was abandoning my best friend, my blood brother. Was that how they turned you? Did it start with small acts of cowardice? I spied a small ravine and hurled my backpack into it. When it hit the ground without triggering a trap, I jumped in after it, frantic to get away from the killing slopes. There was an entrance here, a small crack you could wriggle through. I placed an orange flag from my backpack at the edge of the ravine, a pathetic signal of safety, and then I clenched my rifle tight in both hands, squeezing my way around a bend to inch away from the sunlight and vanish into the grim darkness of rock. I didn't dare pop a glow stick, lest it be a beacon to any waiting trolls. I put a foot down, waited 30 seconds to be sure I hadn't triggered a trap or alerted a sentry. I listened so hard my eardrums popped in the silence. My patience paid off. I heard the snort of trolls echoing back, far down the lightless path. So I crept towards them, and then there was a strobing flare of light and the bark of automatic weapons. I flung myself to the floor, cutting my chin on the muddy rock, before I realized that no one was firing at me. Some other boys, maybe even Stetters, maybe even Roland, were fighting for their lives down at the other end. I clambered to my feet and ran, my heart pumping as I prepared to fire. But by the time I got to the commotion, the noise had echoed down into lazy silence. I poked the barrel of my rifle underneath a piece of burlap cloth they'd tacked between the caverns, smelling the bite of fresh cordite. It was a large scoop of a cave, but the thralls had tried to make a home of it. There were elaborately woven oriental rugs on the floor here, but an unsightly pile of bleeding bodies obscured the pattern. A troll lay with its teeth in the throat of some soldier I couldn't recognize, the soldier digging a knife into its belly. The bodies of humans, mostly dead, lay where they had been shot. The haze of smoke in the air didn't obscure the fact that most of them had ripped off their dog tags, the signs of a deserter who'd gone native. Our boys were all dead. The surviving deserters scrabbled at the ground feebly, trying to get at their grenades. I crossed myself. The poor, brain-burned bastards. I shot them all in the head. I searched the faces, steeling myself to find Roland among the dead. He wasn't there, and I crossed myself in gratitude. It had been a strangely homey space before the slaughter. Electrical lamps placed lovingly into alcoves chipped into the stone. A folding table with a backgammon game in mid-progress sat in the center of the room, never to be finished. The cots had been neatly made, tucked in at the corners. I guess that even the decorai couldn't overwrite the military urge to clean. A pile of letters was stacked neatly on a nightstand. There was no time, but I picked one up and read it anyway. "Dear Elizabeth, I don't expect you to understand. They'll tell you that they took me over, but it's not like that. It's just that once you see the deck awry, you'll understand why we deserve to die. And what follows is a list of very good reasons to kill yourself. I keep this letter a secret from your mother." I crumpled the letter and I flung it down, watching as it slowly uncurled into a puddle of blood on the floor. The rich red blotting out the words. Then I looked up. At the back of this room was an actual door, stolen from someone's farm, painted with cheap gold leaf and the hinges pounded into the hard rock walls. They'd bracketed it with iron bands. I checked that my safety was off, then rolled the smooth eye bead of my Nazar between my fingertips. Was this it? Was this the lair of the Dekarai? And would I know if it took me over? I thought of writing to my niece, giving her a bulleted list of painless ways to commit suicide. My stomach rolled, and I clung to that. As long as I could be sickened, these were my thoughts. That would give me the strength to kill. I pried open the barricades as quietly as I could with my bayonet, then flung the door open. The Dekarai was there, sitting on a cushion, its withered limbs useless and stunted. It had thralls to carry it around. I tensed, waiting for it to attempt to touch my mind, but it simply squatted like a froggy Buddha statue, its skin flecked with gold, long fingers interlaced across its distended belly. Its head was like a fishbowl, too big for its body. Slitted eyes were carved into the round surface. It did not acknowledge my presence. "Sayonara, baby," I grinned, pulling the trigger. And a beam of radiance, filled with dancing motes of fire, opened up inside my mind. "You," it thought happily. Burnished rings of gold exploded like fireworks in the pillar of luminance, twirled around, linking and unlinking. I thought it hadn't noticed me, but that was a lie. It had cataloged every bit of me, knew me better than I knew myself. A wave of glittering affection flooded through me, humiliating me with its intensity. I had never felt anything so strong in my life. For a moment, I was the creature, and the exultation I felt at my own presence, and the presence of all the living beings around me, made me forget everything else. It felt like an angel was reaching its hands out to hold mine. It felt like I was holding worlds like jewels in the palm of my hand. I felt like I had never been human, and never would be again. I struggled to remember my flimsy human concepts as I drowned inside its head. I fought to remember the conception of death, because it had none. It was immortal. I tried to remember words, but they were like jagged knives chipped from rocks, clumsy, harmful, and inefficient when compared to the grace of telepathy. I clenched and unclenched my jaw to try to recall what food was like, but it felt like death in my mouth. The Dekarai subsisted on minerals scraped from cave walls, unable to harm anything. It loved me with a ferocity that terrified me, and loved all of us, which terrified me more. It marked everything, reaching out with its mind to touch the sting flies and the trolls and the humans. I knew the names of everyone in this battle and felt the electric tang of their fear, their overwhelming stench of rage and bloodlust. It made me nauseous, but the Dekarai merely accepted it. It assumed the inherent perfection of every living being. I felt it flipping through the memories of the thousands of people it had met and catalogued, finding their noblest moments and radiating affection. It was the most innocent, beautiful thing I ever saw. And I was surprised as anyone when I buried my bayonet up to the hilt in its chest. But it felt good, so I did it again. Its presence turned my whole world into death. I ate living tissue and crapped into empty places that nourished nothing. I felt my body decaying, the useless inefficiency of the dumb words I formed with the meat of my tongue, the casual way I killed 1,000 things a day and never thought of it, my laughable ideas of brotherhood. Worst of all, I wanted to kill it so I wouldn't have to have my own flaws reflected back at me. God, the letter was right. I should just die. But instead, I grinned with triumph as it cried out in pain, and its incomprehension drove me to fury. Even in death, it didn't fight back. It simply rooted through my mind, unearthing old memories, trying to discover what terrible thing had driven me to do this. So I stabbed it again, and again, and again. And even when I had eradicated every trace of its features and body, I was still standing there, stomping the pieces and screaming until my throat was raw. I was about to put the barrel of the rifle in my mouth when I heard Roland cheering. "Yeah, buddy!" he cried, his boots wet with an angel's blood, and he looked around, his face lit up with a casual cruelty. He thumped his Nazar proudly. "The charm kept you safe, didn't it? You didn't just fight that fucker, you demolished it. You're gonna get a medal for this one, guaranteed." A medal. They wanted to reward this behavior, all so he could fill the world with more squatting ugliness like me. Roland put his arms around me, hugging me tight, and I smelled the ugly pheromones on his skin. He wept with relief, staining my shoulders with water, and as I noted the way his lungs heaved, I understood a great truth. We were just ugly sacks of chemicals, driven by evolutionary responses. Nothing special at all. I'm glad you're safe, he said, pressing his face against my neck. I just went nuts looking for you, man. I even said a prayer to Jesus for you, just in case. But you're the hero now. You totally saved us all. I realized that I had a choice to make. Was it just me who was flawed, or everyone? Quietly, I slid my knife out of the sheath. My thoughts were my own.
You don't get to pick your crucibles. Transformative experiences break across us like the tide, utterly implacable, utterly unchanging, and for the most part, utterly invisible until they swamp you. Then all you can do is hold on and wait for it to pass. But the thing is, it doesn't pass. The human instinct that the status quo will soon be restored proves as useless a lot of the time as our vestigial tales and the belief that any boy band will be together more than a decade. The status is not quo, as the man himself once said, and all we can do is get used to the different world we find ourselves in. That's the bad news, and a lot of the time it's about as bad as it can get. Life becomes trench warfare, and it's impossible, for some of us, not to feel your horizons shrink from planning for the future, to planning for the month, to planning for the week, the end of the day, the next hour. We take our victories when, where, and if we get them, however big or small they are, because each one holds the promise of change not for the worse, but for the better. The good news, and a lot of the time it's as good as it can get, is that times like this render us down to our best elements. When you're faced with the big choices, you tend to surprise yourself. There's a moment in David Mamet's excellent and unfairly overlooked Red Belt that comes to mind, a mantra that the main character lives by. There's always an escape. And there always is. There's always a right choice, always a way to get a victory or something close enough to it. All you have to do is be brave enough to take it. And believe me, however bad it gets, we're all brave enough. To go back to my long-standing tradition of taking well-known quotes and going, actually, incredibly famous, successful person, I think you'll find you're a little bit wrong. David Bowie got within sight of the point. But for me, it's a little more accurate to say we are all heroes, and for more than just one day. If you're feeling particularly heroic, oh, come on, did you honestly think I wasn't going for that line? Have you met me? Then why not donate? We rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you'll make a lot of people very, very happy. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Our exit music is I Am an Island by Hopeful Machines. For more information, please go to hopefulmachines.net. And Pseudopod will be back next week, sure as silence follows rain.